Welcome to the Unbound Healing Podcast. I'm Anne-Marie Garland, nutritional therapist and health coach at Grassfed Salsa. And with me is my co-host, Michelle Hoover, certified nutritional therapy practitioner and writer of everything you'll find at Unbound Wellness. Here we share everything about overcoming health challenges from autoimmunity to hormone imbalance and more, with holistic living, mindset shifts, practical tips, and a real food paleo approach. Remember our disclaimer, the content within this podcast is intended to provide general information and is not to be substituted for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Now let's get on with the show.
What is up, you guys? Today we have a fun special interview with Dr. Lawrence Afrin. So Dr. Afrin is a pioneer in the field of researching mast cell activation disease or mast activation syndrome. So we are so excited to have somebody like him here on the podcast speaking about this as an expert. It is so needed. This is really important research and work that he's doing on this specific disease. Now, one thing that I will say is if you're new to our podcast or if you're new to the holistic health world, just dipping your toes in the water, mast cell activation disease is probably not the place that you want to start. It's a little bit more of an advanced topic, as you will hear, that there's a lot of things going on, a lot of stuff you want to address. So don't get overwhelmed by it if you're starting here. But if you haven't heard of mast cell activation disease before, it is a great resource to listen to. So here we have Dr. Lawrence Afrin. We're here today to talk all about mast cell activation disease syndrome. And this is a heavier topic than what we have covered before on the podcast. So we really want to kind of start with the basics and then build from there. So as a leader in the industry and in this research, can you tell us kind of just what it is and how this research came about? Because it's really only since about, from what I found, 1991, since this started really coming to light.
Well, actually, 1991 is when there was merely the first publication of the concept that a disease such as mast cell activation syndrome ought to exist. Mm. You have to fast forward another 16 years to get to 2007 when the first case reports of the disease were actually first published. So we've really only known about the existence of the disease for a decade now. Mm. What it is, it's an extraordinarily complex disease. I mean, if it were simple, we would have figured it out a long time ago. But to try to put it into a capsule, it is a chronic multi-system disorder with general themes of inflammation. That's pretty much a universal constant with MCAS, plus minus various allergic type phenomena. And I say plus minus because there are some MCAS patients who really don't have a speck of allergic type troubles, and others who suffer allergic type troubles to nearly life-threatening, nearly constant degree. And those are the two sort of opposite ends of that spectrum, and then all the other patients somewhere in between. So inflammation plus minus allergic type phenomena. And more recently, we've been recognizing there's another plus minus to this syndrome as well, and that's plus minus abnormalities in growth or development in potentially any tissue. And that's often a good bit more difficult to recognize clinically. So, I mean, what I've just described is obviously a very broad, very nebulous condition, and that constitutes a large part of the challenge in clinically recognizing this. I mean, why has it been only in the last 10 years that we've begun to recognize this exists? It's because the biology of this disease is such that it can present clinically in so many different ways that it's hard to recognize. I mean, when we go through our medical training, we learn about, you know, many, many different diseases, and we learn the particular pattern with which each disease presents. I mean, that is what diagnosis is, whether you're in medicine or automobile repair or anything else. It's an art of pattern recognition. And most diseases present with one or two or, you know, a very small number of patterns. But now suddenly the doctor is faced with this disease whose essential biology virtually guarantees the disease is going to present in hundreds, if not potentially even thousands of different ways. And you know, it's difficult to recognize that. One has to sort of step back and look at the big picture of what's going on in the patient to recognize the broad themes that I just recognized. Mast cell patients often acquire over the years, you know, they see many doctors, acquire many different diagnoses, and try many different treatments, most of which tend to not help all that much. And it's not that any of those diagnoses are wrong, except for the frequent accusations of psychosomatism, you know, patients just imagining the symptoms. That's not right. But the other diagnoses, it's not that they're wrong. It's just that each of them accounts for only one subset or another of the totality of what's long been going on in the patient. And, you know, when the patient has acquired, 15, 30, 60 different diagnoses, at some point you've got to ask yourself, is this patient really so uniquely unlucky as to have coincidentally acquired so many different problems, all of them developing independently of one another? Or is it more likely that there's just one thing going on in this patient that accounts for most or all of the problems that have been observed? And you know, obviously, in the universe we live in, it's more likely there's just one thing going on at the root of it all. It's just that, again, we didn't even know the existence of this up until just a few years ago. And the fact is that here we are a decade since the first case reports, and it's still the case that, you know, this is not in, medical school curricula. Generally not being taught in residency programs or fellowship programs. And so most doctors, even coming through training today, haven't even heard of this, much less have a good understanding of how it can present. And that's really the first, you know, hurdle. If when a patient comes to you with you know, certain, you know, symptoms and findings, and if you're not even aware that the disease exists, then how are you going to diagnose it?
Yeah, that's so interesting, because our audience, coming from the autoimmune space, there's just this laundry list of things that we usually deal with, and we'll talk about different root causes and different symptoms, and people can just say, yes, all of the above, I'm dealing with all of it. And yeah, in allopathic medicine, so often things are just siloed off, saying that, okay, if you have reflux, it's this. If you have migraines, it's this. And, you know, we're slowly trying to get together and say, no, it's all one thing that is presenting in all these different ways. But as you know, that's very slow going.
Yeah, and I want to be careful here. I mean, let's be clear that I'm not saying that mast cell activation disease or syndrome, you know, is the explanation for every patient with long, mysterious, multi-system inflammation and allergic type phenomena. Not saying that at all. But what I am saying is that, you know, here in 2017, we now understand that there actually does exist a disease that works in this fashion and is capable of producing a, you know, vast range of inflammatory and allergic and growth type problems. And so when a patient presents with, you know, a set of problems that potentially fits this profile, it now becomes reasonable to consider this newly recognized diagnosis. And it's not a new diagnosis, it's not a new disease. There there really are very, very few truly new diseases. You know, maybe new infection, so to speak, like HIV or SARS or whatever. But otherwise, there really aren't any new diseases. It's just that our ability to recognize various diseases is improving with time, and we've come to newly recognize this thing that we call MCAS.
So what are some of those common signs and symptoms that someone might be able to use to in order to get a proper diagnosis?
Well, patients who have this, we typically, on a careful history, are able to trace symptoms that are potentially, you know, stemming from this disease. We're able to trace those symptoms back at least to adolescence in most patients who have this, and sometimes even back to childhood or even infancy. And if you just look at the, as I said, the inflammatory part of this, patients develop all sorts of inflammatory issues in the respiratory tract and the gastrointestinal tract and sometimes in the musculoskeletal system, sometimes in the genitourinary system, sometimes the central and peripheral nervous systems, cardiovascular systems. There's really not a single system or organ or tissue in the body that is immune to potentially being affected by this disease. Not even the immune system is immune. So there certainly is a wide array of abnormalities that can develop in the immune system too. So patients, for example, may suffer frequent problems with sinusitis, bronchitis, ear infections, a variety of gastrointestinal problems, nausea, vomiting, reflux that seems refractory to all manners of medication, diarrhea alternating, frequently alternating with constipation. Patients with mast cell activation syndrome often have previously been given diagnoses of irritable bowel syndrome and fibromyalgia and chronic fatigue syndrome and postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome and hypermobility Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. And again, let's be careful here. I'm not saying that, you know, every patient with, say, you know, chronic fatigue syndrome necessarily has mast cell activation syndrome at the root of their troubles. But nevertheless, mast cell activation can produce chronic fatigue that, you know, can result in the patient being diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome. And sometimes if you can identify that it actually is a mast cell activation syndrome that's at the root of the chronic fatigue or the fibromyalgia or the irritable bowel, and then you provide treatment for mast cell activation, then sometimes patients can get significantly better.
So, I mean, you listing all of those symptoms, it's kind of like had my ears perk up because I've been diagnosed with many of those things. And
yeah, we talked about a lot of those.
Yeah. And so it's interesting. I don't think that I have this disorder, but if somebody were like me and they felt that they had a lot of these common symptoms, how would you suggest they go about getting tested for it or finding a practitioner that's educated on it in order to get that proper diagnosis and not just be really worried about it and internalizing this because they feel overwhelmed with even trying to get that proper diagnosis?
Yeah. Where does one even start?
That's an excellent question. And
loaded.
There are an awful lot of people out there who struggle with that. And I'm not sure there's one right or best answer for that at present. I mean, the fact is that there still is a pretty small number of physicians scattered around the world who have a good degree of familiarity with this. And, you know, one might start by asking, for example, whether a local allergist might know of a colleague who has good familiarity with this. One could perhaps contact patient support resources for mast cell diseases. For example, here in the U.S., the Mastocytosis Society tends to keep abreast of physician and other healthcare professional resources for helping patients deal with the various mast cell diseases. So, you know, there's a variety of routes that can be pursued, but you're right. You probably do, if you're thinking it makes sense to be evaluated for this, probably is a good idea to get into the hands of a healthcare professional who does have some familiarity with this, because the testing, I'll be the first to admit, the testing is not simple or trivial. It's, again, a complex disease. The testing is complex. The treatment is complex. But in spite of all that complexity, I myself have chosen to persist in this area because I've been very encouraged by seeing so many patients now who have turned out to have this at the root of their decades-long chronic mysterious illness. And I've seen so many of these patients actually achieve significant improvement with one mast cell targeted treatment regimen or another. And it's just really encouraging to see patients who have been unwell for years to decades, many of them understandably having given up hope and even having begun wondering whether that begun wondering themselves whether the symptoms are real, because so many times they've been told the problems are, that they're just imagining them, that they're psychosomatic. And it's just really nice to see so many of these patients finally achieving significant improvement in their quality of life. You can't cure this at present, and it's way too complex a disease for it to be reasonable to expect to get to a point where you're feeling perfect. And frankly, you can't even get to a point where you're feeling significantly improved all the time. But in my experience, if both the patient who has this and the treating physician are sufficiently patient and persistent and methodical in stepping through trials of the various mast cell targeted therapies, the majority of patients with this do manage to eventually, some sooner, some later, but eventually find some mast cell targeted cocktail, if you will, that does help them feel significantly better than the pre-treatment baseline the majority of the time. And compared to how they were doing before, that's a desirable goal for many of them.
It is.
That's a satisfactory goal for many of them.
Yeah. Yeah. I've read a lot of your just patient testimonies online, and it's really amazing the work that you do, to just give people their lives back, because we both live in this, Anne and I both come from this chronic illness background of ourselves and work with so many people who do. And it's debilitating to have all of these issues and go to these doctors and be told it's psychosomatic or there's nothing we can really do. And to be able to have a key that unlocks my own holistic doctor, what she tells me is what we want to do is we want to get to the root of the root of the root of the root. Like, what is the bottom line as far as what is going on biologically in your body that we can, target all of these things. And that's way easier said than done. And it's complicated even with figuring out something like this, that you're dealing with mast cell, but it's just really empowering to know, to have answers.
I agree. I have many patients who have expressed great happiness even while they continue to suffer symptoms of the disease. Nevertheless, they express great happiness just from finally learning that they really do have a quote real disease unquote. Mm-hmm. It's not imaginary. I do want to further clarify, though, that not necessarily everyone who has this is so symptomatic as to be disabled from it. There's, again, it's a very complex disease. It presents across a very wide spectrum of types of illness and severities of illness, and there are a great many people who have this to a very mild degree. I wouldn't be surprised if the majority of people who have this actually will never diagnose because they're so mildly afflicted. They just really rarely or never come to the attention of a doctor. But then there are those who are somewhat more significantly afflicted. And then there are the unfortunate but relatively few who are just very severely afflicted and completely disabled by it. And the approach to treatment just needs to be tailored to the individual. Unfortunately, the state of the science in this area at present remains so immature that even though it's good news that we have a great many medications that have been shown helpful for improving various symptoms in various patients with mast cell disease, at present, we're still a long way away from being able to predict which medications are most likely to help which symptoms in which patients. So there really is no shortcut at present to taking a trial and error approach. And it's just a good thing that we've got a lot of things to try. I mean, it would be a much worse situation, of course, if we only had a few things to try. But fortunately, we have many things to try.
Is there something that tends to be an environmental or a dietary trigger that happens for some of these people where if maybe they were one of those that had a mild case and then all of a sudden all of their symptoms kind of flared up? So we know that this is something that's been going on since potentially childhood, but something seems to trigger it. Have you seen any patterns in things that may do that?
I can't point to any one particular food or environmental exposure that seems to be a more troublesome trigger than others. I mean, the general, I should say the natural history, the natural course of the disease seems to be a steady waxing and waning of various symptoms over time. Chronic unwellness to some degree with, you know, waxings and wanings from one day to the next, and sometimes punctuated by acute, more significant flares or spells or exacerbations of symptoms. But then every once in a while, and that pattern I just described, that can easily percolate along for many years, many, many years. But there's always the potential in patients with mast cell activation syndrome to experience a relatively sharp and significant and unfortunately often permanent escalation in the baseline misbehavior of the disease. You can sort of picture it in your head as a stepwise escalation in the misbehavior of the disease. And when these escalations happen, unfortunately, they don't seem to happen all that often, but when they happen, they tend to shortly follow by maybe a few days or weeks, occasionally a few months, but they tend to shortly follow a major stressor, which could be either a physical stressor, for example, trauma or surgery or a major infection or perhaps even pregnancy and childbirth. Or it could be a major psychological or emotional stressor. For example, you know, death of a loved one or, you know, sudden serious, you know, financial insecurities. But either way, physical or psychological, a major stressor sometimes can trigger a sharp escalation in the misbehavior of the disease. And I don't want to give the wrong impression. I'm certainly not saying that every stressor is going to trigger an escalation of the disease. All I'm saying is that when escalations of the sort I've described, you know, do happen, they tend to shortly follow a major stressor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we see that a lot in what we do with our clients and in ourselves, that it's really helpful in trying to figure out your own autoimmunity or chronic illness to go back and say, okay, there had to be a trigger for this. What was the trigger? And, you know, we see a lot of the same things, infection and heavy metal and emotional stressors. And I deal a lot with women with Hashimoto's disease, and I see a lot of women coming with postpartum, that pregnancy is a huge stressor on the body as well. So yeah, that's all the sort of things that we definitely would have predicted. In our world and what we do here, it's a lot of holistic care for autoimmunity and chronic illness and, you know, this whole spectrum. So as far as, and as we've been talking about, this is very complex and it presents differently in a lot of different people that, that doesn't change. But the question that I think is a lot on a lot of our minds is, what are some holistic protocols that people will take with mast cell as far as dietary, environmental, lifestyle strategies? What sorts of things have you seen that are successful, generally speaking?
Well, I think some of the biggest successes come from paying rigorous attention to what many experts feel is, quote, step one, unquote, in managing this condition. And that actually has nothing to do with any particular medications, but rather is simply identifying one's triggers as precisely as possible and then doing one's best to avoid them going forward. I mean, it's always possible that as time goes on and then the patient identifies various treatments for helping gain better control over the misbehaving mast cells, it's always possible that substances and exposures which might have been triggers previously, you know, the patient may gain improved tolerance for those triggers over time. I've seen many patients who, for example, had come to me with an extraordinarily restricted diet and with, you know, various treatments over time, they had regained the ability to tolerate many of the foods that they previously had not been able to tolerate. But to begin with, it really does help to identify one's triggers as precisely as possible, whether that's, you know, food or beverage or environmental antigen like pollens or even physical forces. I mean, mast cells, when they're not functioning properly, they sometimes can abnormally activate in response to changes in temperature, sometimes, you know, exposure to cold or heat, or sometimes on exposure to changes in air pressure. You know, for example, I have some patients who suffer flares of symptoms when they're in a plane that is ascending, and then they stabilize in flight, but then when the plane starts descending and then the pressure starts increasing again, they start having more symptoms, and they learn to, you know, various approaches to managing those flares, such as pre-medicating, you know, before the plane goes up or the plane goes down, or you know, in that fashion. So identifying triggers is really important. And I should mention too that in this same vein, that mast cell activation patients seem to have quite a propensity for reacting not so much to the drugs that they take, although to be clear, there certainly are a number of drugs which can be provocative to misbehaving mast cells. But what I find is that when a mast cell patient is suffering an adverse reaction to a medication product, overall, it's more likely that the reaction is directed at one or more of what we call the excipients in the medication product that's being consumed, the so-called inactive ingredients, the fillers, the binders, the dyes, the preservatives. And mast cell patients can have quite a propensity to react to the excipients. And I caution my patients with mast cell activation disease that when they have that experience where they're, you know, trying a new medication product and they start having an adverse reaction fairly rapidly out of the starting gate, so to speak, and particularly if the drug is an ordinarily well-tolerated drug, that's a situation where you really have to wonder about excipient reactivity, and it often pays off for the patient to quickly return to the pharmacist and have a sit-down consultation with the pharmacist to review the full ingredient list for the particular formulation of the drug that was issued to the patient, and try to identify which excipient is the likely trigger. And sometimes the pharmacist can help further to figure this out, because if you identify that, oh, I think it's red dye number 40 that's the problem, then perhaps the pharmacist can simply find an alternative formulation of the drug that just doesn't have red dye number 40 in it. And if the patient, you know, takes the alternative formulation and doesn't have the problem they were having with the first formulation, well, congratulations, you've proven it's not the drug that's the problem, that it must have been the excipient that was in the poorly tolerated formulation, and which is not in the well-tolerated formulation. And when you finally figure out that it's, again, I'm just using red dye number 40 as an example, there are hundreds, if not thousands, of excipients that are incorporated into modern medication products. But when you finally figure out that it's red dye number 40 that's a trigger for your mast cell activation disease, then it's red dye number 40 that should go on your allergy list at your doctor's office and your pharmacist, and your pharmacist and you and the doctor all need to work together to be sure that you don't get exposed to that again. It's very difficult for medications of any sort to gain good control over misbehaving mast cells when the patient is simultaneously and persistently ingesting or otherwise exposing herself to a known trigger. We just have to be aware of the general notion that there's more in our medication products than just the drug, just the active drug. There's all sorts of other material, and mast cell patients sometimes can be reactive to some of those other substances.
Yeah, I think it's really good how you're explaining all of this. It makes it seem like this is a very like every approach for the individual needs to be completely personalized, and they need support through their own N equals one experiment of figuring out what it is that they're reacting to and all of that. So I think it's really important that these people do seek out the right professional to be working through this process with. Right.
Well, my hope is that before not much longer, but who knows when that will be, the state of the science in this area will advance to the point where we will be able to begin predicting which drugs, which medications, which other non-pharmacologic approaches will be most likely to help which symptoms in which patients. I mean, there has to be a reason why a given patient is having, you know, a given clinical presentation and having a response to this medicine but not that medicine. There has to be a reason for it. It's just that the reasons probably lie down at the molecular level, with all sorts of very complex molecular mechanisms within the mast cells, and perhaps other types of cells too. And we're just not at the point yet of being able to understand those patterns in sufficient detail to be able to, you know, correlate, for example, certain biological markers in one patient with response to this drug, but not response to that drug. I mean, once we can finally get to the point where we can start putting together such correlations, then we'll finally be able to start predicting. But it's going to be a good long while yet before we get to that point.
Where I believe I got my intro into mast cell activation is through the world of histamine intolerance, which is very prominent in our community of autoimmunity, where kind of people will start by saying, oh, I have autoimmune issues. Oh, actually, I have gut issues. Oh, maybe I actually have histamine issues. And then when you go one level deeper than that, it actually could be mast cell issues. And of course, everybody's different. But can you talk maybe about, I know a lot of people that deal with this, they go the route of low histamine. So kind of why does that work? And then how does the outcome look? Because a lot of people that go this low histamine route, they're saying, okay, well, now what's the way out? Now how do I get, you know, a can of sardines back in my life without reacting to it? So is there any kind of movement that way? Or,
well, again, I think helping that patient get sardines back in her life is going to depend on understanding at a much more detailed level the particular molecular variant of mast cell disease that patient has, and that'll help guide treatment decisions as to, you know, which interventions will be most likely to help control the mast cell dysfunction in that particular patient. With regard to histamine, low histamine diets, I actually see many of my patients trying not only low histamine diets, but just a wide variety of diets. And I don't think there's much of a problem with trying any particular diet, as long as it's a halfway reasonable diet that's still going to get the patient sufficient, basic nutrition. But I look at a change in diet to be in a mast cell patient to be every bit as significant as a change in medication. And in the same fashion in which I recommend my patients try to make just one change at a time in their medication regimen, I recommend making just one dietary change too. So in other words, if you want to try a low histamine diet, and I'll acknowledge right now that there are many different low histamine diets out there.
Yeah,
there's certainly no universal standard for that. But if a patient wants to try a low histamine diet, that's fine. Go ahead and try that. But if after a month, you know, make that change and don't change anything else in the regimen. If one can help it, you know, don't go changing any medications. Don't go, you know, relocating to a different household or a different town. Try to keep everything, all the other variables, you know, steady, and then make that one change in the diet. And if after a month you can't honestly say, oh yeah, I'm obviously significantly better because of this one change, if you can't say that, then no, that's not going to be part of the solution set for effectively managing and controlling your particular variant of mast cell activation syndrome. If you come back after a month and the best that you can say is, well, I kind of sort of maybe feel a little bit better. Nope. In my book, that's not nearly good enough. It's been my pretty consistent experience that when the patient finds the interventions, whether they're drugs or diet or you know, other environmental changes, when the patient finds the interventions that happen to be the right, call it molecular keys for fitting into the particular molecular lock that is any given mast cell patient's particular variant of the syndrome, they will come back in just a month and I walk in the exam room and my head just spins 360 because I can't believe how much better they look. It's just obvious. I mean, sometimes I don't even need to have a conversation with the patient. It's so obvious. So those interventions, those are the keepers.
Yeah.
Interventions that don't measure up to that, they're not worth keeping in the regimen. If you keep a medication, for example, in the regimen because it sort of kind of maybe helps the patient feel a little bit better, you will so quickly get to the point of having such a complex regimen with so many medications in it. It is just fundamentally unmanageable, unsustainable. It is medically toxic. It is financially toxic. That's just not the way to proceed here. And so you keep the interventions that clearly make a significant difference and you ditch the rest. And I'm not saying that any given intervention will necessarily bring about dramatic improvement in all of the patient's symptoms. But nevertheless, if it's going to be a keeper, then whatever symptoms it is going to address, there's going to be obvious, significant improvement in those symptoms.
Mm-hmm. We talked about recently, Ann and I, that we both follow a autoimmune protocol template. And I know when I started, it was immediate that I noticed just a huge reduction in inflammation. And, you know, I was not 100% in 30 days by any means, but, you know, I felt a difference for sure. So.
Good. I want to mention one other thing about, I know that there is some confusion among some patients about whether mast cell activation disease is an autoimmune disease or not. And maybe if I could take just a couple of minutes to address that.
We would
because
love that.
The answer is we really don't know. Mm. And you know, autoimmune disease, what that means, what that class of diseases is, are diseases in which the immune system has generated, has, you know, inappropriately and erroneously generated antibodies that target, you know, one tissue or another, one type of cell or another, in a fashion that leads to dysfunction of that cell or tissue, which then ultimately results in certain clinical symptoms, a syndrome that gets recognized as disease X. So, you know, the classic example is the anti-nuclear antibody, ANA, that is associated with lupus and some other rheumatologic diseases as well. And there are a small number thus far of autoantibodies which do seem to have potential for causing abnormal activation of the mast cell. But it is far from clear that it is autoimmunity that is at the root of the improper mast cell activation in most patients who have a mast cell activation syndrome. There are other studies in the literature suggesting that many patients with mast cell activation syndrome appear to have mutations in various regulatory genes and other elements in the mast cell. And these are not usually not inherited mutations. They appear to be acquired for the most part.
Interesting.
Usually relatively early in life. But you can envision how if a mast cell regulatory gene is mutated in a particular way, that too could lead to improper mast cell activation and improper mast cell reactivity. And so there's a good bit of controversy at present as to what portion of the total population of patients with mast cell activation syndrome have mutations in the mast cells at the root of their troubles versus what portion might have autoantibodies at the root of the trouble. And there might even be other mechanisms too. In fact, it's possible that the mast cells in some patients with mast cell activation syndrome might be entirely normal and that the mast cells are simply being normally activated in response to something else. And we call that sort of secondary mast cell activation as opposed to primary mast cell activation from mutations. And the fact is that we just don't have any way in the clinic and in routine practice these days to make a clear distinction in most patients as to whether the disease is primary or secondary. But at the same time, although that would be a good question to answer in the long run in each patient, and though it might better help us target various treatments to various patients with this, nevertheless, even if we can't figure out whether the disease is primary or secondary in any given patient in whom we can diagnose it, in any given patient in whom we can detect the presence of the disease. Nevertheless, if we are able to detect its presence and if there's no other identifiable diagnosis in the patient that better accounts for the full range and duration of all the symptoms and findings in the patient, then even if it's a secondary mast cell activation and we just can't figure out what the primary cause is, nevertheless, it's still the best diagnosis, the best sort of root explanation that's been determined in the patient to date, and it still makes sense to at least try to address the improper, to try to control the improper mast cell activation in those patients to see if you might actually get better control over the symptoms, better quality of life compared to the outcomes that we're seeing with any other treatments that were given for other previous less encompassing diagnoses in the patient's past. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like all of this is, it's a lot to take in, just this entire syndrome, which you know, you've discussed this for sure, that this is something that is, you know, still in process for us to just wrap our heads around.
Yeah. We need to go easy on our doctors.
Yeah.
I mean, the profession is going to be learning about this for decades and decades to come.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact is that no doctor presently is taught about this in training, and or at least very few are. And, you know, doctors are having, for the most part, they're having to learn about it, you know, quote, on the fly, unquote.
Yeah.
And it's a complex thing to learn about. It takes a lot of time, a lot of effort, and we just need to all, you know, have an understanding that this is challenging, and let's not go about expecting that just because, you know, there are, you know, a number of publications about this in the literature, that sort of automatically means that every doctor knows about it and knows how to diagnose and treat it. You know, that's not at all the case.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh yeah,
let's go easy on the doctors.
Yeah,
such an important piece of advice right there,
to give grace to the doctors, because
right.
The company, before I went out on my own, the ministry that I work for, the CEO, he would say that doctors are practicing, that doctors are people too, and they're learning every day, just like we are, especially with, you know, really complex topics like this, that it's not 100% figured out, and one person cannot have all the answers. So I think giving grace is really important. But what I can say for sure is that we're really grateful for people like you out there that are just spearheading this thing, that are, you know, bringing a lot of this to light and doing all of this work to really bring this out. And I know that the hundreds of people that are going to listen to this, and the, you know, thousands of people whose lives you're able to touch for it, it's just, you know, it's huge.
Well, I'm always glad to see any patient, you know, get a more accurate diagnosis, whether it's this disease or any other disease, and through a more accurate diagnosis, then achieve more effective treatment. It's always nice mm-hmm. to see patients get better, but, you know, from my perspective, you can imagine, you know, the shoes I walk in, it's even better to see a doctor coming to better understand this, because
mm-hmm.
you know, the multiplier effect from that is obvious. So
I'd love to have you share with our listeners where they can find you, and if you have any books or a website for them to go to. But I also was wondering if you, I'm sure we'll get people who are interested, are you taking on patients currently? I know you're kind of in a transitionary phase of your life.
Yeah, I'm in a transition right now. I'm going to be joining forces with an integrative medicine physician, an excellent internist, Dr. Tanya Dempsey, and together we're going to be developing an independent institute for advancing the care, research, and education in this area. I am continuing to see patients. As you said, I'm in a transition right now for about a month, but I expect to be resuming practice in the next month or two. But fair warning to any listeners, the waiting list is quite long. And although I personally don't have any problem with people getting added to the end of it, it probably makes more sense for patients to try to find a local physician who is not necessarily already understanding or, you know, not necessarily already aware of or understanding of the disease, because again, most doctors are not going to be aware of it. But nevertheless, you're looking for a local doctor who is willing to learn about new things in medicine and willing to at least try to help the patient deal with this. You know, one of the nice things about trying to manage this disease is that even though it's a complex disease, the fact is that the large majority of the medications that make sense to try for mast cell disease are medications that are pretty innocuous overall and are well within the ability of any physician to prescribe and manage. It's just that they might not have previously used these medicines previously for mast cell disease, you know, specifically. But they've heard of these medicines, many of them, and it's hard to imagine they would be uncomfortable with prescribing and managing just the short, you know, say 1 month trial of each medication that would be needed to see whether it's going to significantly help the patient or not. So if you can find a local physician who's willing to learn about this and willing to at least try to help, then, you know, it's probably better to just, you know, ask that doctor. If that doctor is unsure of, you know, how to proceed with the diagnostic workup or with, you know, therapeutic trials, then just ask that doctor to contact some other physician who has experience with this. And I can't speak for any colleagues, of course, but I myself, I'm always happy to help another physician or other healthcare professionals learn about this, because again, the multiplier effect is just obvious. So, any healthcare professional who wants further guidance in this area, they're most welcome to contact me. I'm happy to provide pointers to, you know, people who are looking for pointers, and I'm happy to support as best I can, you know, any colleagues who are interested in learning more about this so that they can help, you know, their own patients.
That's wonderful. It's so good when you hear other practitioners who are just on a mission to get people the information they need and not seeing things as competition. So that's really great to hear. Okay, well, do you want to share your website or anything else before we hop off?
Well, we actually are in the process of putting together a website for the new institute at present. It hasn't gone online yet, so I'm afraid there really isn't any website to share at this point.
We can update in the show notes when there is. So if people are listening a couple of months from now, they can follow up from there.
Sure.
Yeah. So we'll get that from you in a few months then, once it goes live.
Yeah. We'll let everybody know. Also, well, thank you so much for getting together with us. This is a topic that I've been scared of for a while to really tackle. Every time I open an article, it's like my eyes are crossing like halfway through it. So being able to do the research just to prep for this episode and then being able to learn from you while we were recording it is very helpful for me. So we thank you so much for coming on today and are definitely looking forward to everything else.
Great. Well, again, I appreciate the the opportunity I've come to appreciate much better in this last decade that I've been falling down this mast cell rabbit hole, so to speak. I've come to much better appreciate just how empowering knowledge is. Just simply better understanding this can lead to so many improvements in so many directions. So thanks for the opportunity, and good luck with all that you do.
Thank you. All right. Bye, everyone.
Thanks so much for listening to the Unbound Healing Podcast. Be sure to subscribe in iTunes and leave us a review. Until next time, you can find more from me, Anne, at grassfedsalsa.com, and more from Michelle at unboundwellness.com. We'll see you next week. Bye.